Today is Wednesday, October 28th, and you're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, the voters who may decide the next president of the United States.
We elected him to get things done, and he's doing exactly what he said he would.
I think it would be devastating if I had to look forward to another 4 years of the Trump administration.
Also ahead, why a vaccine may not immediately end the pandemic.
There's a lot of questions about the vaccine that we just don't know right now. And the most obvious one is we just don't know how well it's going to work.
Plus, Nagorno-Karabakh could be a new battleground between Turkey and Russia. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in the U.S., where only 6 days remain until voting finishes in nationwide elections. While most of the focus is on the presidential contest, U.S. Senate races could hold the key to whether the next president can enact his agenda. VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports on a hard-fought Senate race in the small state of Iowa.
In 2016, Donald Trump carried the central state of Iowa by 9 percentage points. Farmer Dan Zumba was pleased.
We elected him to get things done, and he's doing exactly what he said he would.
4 years later, a global pandemic and a trade war impacting Iowa's agricultural economy have led to a tight race between President Donald Trump and Democratic challenger Joe Biden. Farmer Doug Thompson wants change.
I think it would be devastating if I had to look forward to another 4 years of the Trump administration.
Iowa could also determine whether Republicans hold or lose their slim Senate majority. Republican first-term Senator Joni Ernst raised eyebrows when she fumbled a question on farm commodity prices during a debate with her Democratic challenger, real estate executive Teresa Greenfield.
I think you had asked about corn, and it depends on what the inputs are, but probably about $5.50.
Well, you're a couple dollars off, I think, here, because it's 10:05, so we'll move on to something else.
Moments earlier, Greenfield had no trouble answering a similar question.
Well, a bushel of corn's going for about $3.68 today, $3.69.
Farmer Dan Zumba, who previously served with Ernst in the Iowa State Senate, said the debates left an unfair impression of Ernst.
They made a lot of to-do about absolutely nothing. Senator Ernst understands agriculture.
Farmer Doug Thompson supports Greenfield and says the Trump administration's trade war with China, backed by Ernst, lowered grain prices and hurt him financially.
Her success or failure is going to be based on Trump's success or failure in Iowa.
Government payments compensating farmers for lost income haven't reassured Thompson.
Agriculture has been devastated. Even though that we've been paid off, there's still a lot of stress out here. A lot of stress on balance sheets, if you will.
Iowa is among America's top producing states of corn, pork, and eggs. Polls show the state's economy is the top issue for voters. Many analysts expect Democrats to boost their numbers in the Senate. The question is, by how many?
There are about a half a dozen races where Republicans seem to be vulnerable this time. Iowa is one of those states.
The University of Iowa's Timothy Hagel says independent voters, about one-third of Iowa's electorate, are key to the Ernst Greenfield contest.
It's how those no-party voters, those independents vote that's critical, and they're the swing voters. Do they really care about some of this political infighting, or does that just turn them off at a certain point?
Some Iowans, like Farmer Doug Thompson, are voting early.
My ballot is in my kitchen, waiting my signature.
Amid the pandemic, early voting in Iowa is up 97% compared to 2016. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Over 60 million people have already cast their ballots in the U.S., and one group seeing more access to the votes than before are people who were formerly incarcerated. In some U.S. states, people with felony convictions may be barred from voting even after they have served their sentences. Reuters reports that the Sentencing Project, which advocates for criminal justice reform, says felony convictions will disenfranchise about 5.2 million Americans this year, but that is down 15% from 2016. The group says this year's presidential election is the first since 1976 in which the number of Americans unable to vote because of a felony conviction has declined. For more on voting for formerly incarcerated people and how it might impact the election, I reached out to VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. Chris, can you explain what's going on with voting for ex-felons, especially in the state of Florida?
Well, Florida is trying to get former criminal felons off the voting rolls as early voting is already underway in the state and millions of people have already voted in early voting. But it comes as the Supreme Court back in July basically ruled that Florida can bar people with felony convictions from voting unless they have paid fees, fines, and other restitution. And it comes as an attempt to water down a 2018 law on felon voting rights that ended this lifetime voting ban for most felons. Until then, they were not allowed to vote at all. But the legislature, a year later, limited that right to people who have paid court order fines or fees. Now, a University of Florida study estimates some 775,000 felons in the state have these court debts and would not be eligible to vote. And the state says about 85,000 voters on Florida's voting rolls could be ineligible to vote. And this is in another key battleground state that President Trump won by less than 113,000 votes in 2016. So not allowing ex-felons to vote may favor President Trump and the Republican Party in the state.
And what's the reasoning for these requirements that people pay those fees and restitutions before they're allowed to vote?
They say that this is the only way for these ex-felons to actually achieve full restitution if they pay these fines. And they also fear that a lot of ineligible people will try to vote. Now, civil rights groups had sued basically saying that this is in violation of equal protection principles of the 24th Amendment, which bars poll tax. And these ex-felons would have to pay in some cases $1,000 or more to wipe out their debt, which would allow them to register to vote. And these civil rights groups are basically saying these are poor people, they don't have that money, and you're basically asking them to pay money to vote.
You mentioned that not allowing ex-felons to vote may favor President Trump and the Republican Party. Why is that?
A majority of these ex-felons are minorities, a lot of African-American men, and those men tend to vote for the Democrats. Political analysts say this would clearly help the president because it would disenfranchise people who may otherwise be voting for the Democrat and former Vice President Joe Biden.
Now, there are also efforts by some Democrats to help ex-felons pay off these debts. What's been going on with those efforts?
Well, they're pretty big efforts, and there clearly is a lot of outrage around the country for what's going on down in Florida by preventing these ex-felons with court debt from being able to vote. And last month, former Democratic presidential candidate and billionaire Michael Bloomberg helped to raise $16 million to pay for these felons' debts and allow them to register to vote. And basically, there were more than 44,000 individuals and other entities that joined Bloomberg on this donor list to pay off some of these felons' court debt, again, allowing them to vote. The Florida Restoration Coalition estimates that Bloomberg and others' efforts have paid court debts for about 32,000 felons, restoring their voting rights to right what they call a very sad situation of disenfranchising people's voting rights in Florida.
That was VOA National Affairs correspondent Chris Simpkins. Protests continued Tuesday night in multiple cities in the U.S. against the death of Walter Wallace Jr., a black man in the city of Philadelphia. Police shot Wallace Monday afternoon after telling him to drop a knife. In New York, police arrested about 30 people as hundreds of protesters took to the streets in Brooklyn late Tuesday. In Philadelphia, where protests turned violent earlier in the week, a lawyer for Wallace's family said the 27-year-old was taking medication for mental illness and was having a health crisis when he was killed. He said the family had called for an ambulance, but armed police officers arrived instead. But police officials say they had received a call about a man saying he was armed with a knife, but could not confirm what information had been given to the responding officers. AP's Tim McGuire has the story.
The parents of a Philadelphia man shot and killed by police are looking for answers as they call for calm. Catherine Wallace says she begged two Philadelphia police officers not to shoot her 27-year-old son, Walter Jr., who was apparently armed with a knife while having a mental health crisis Monday afternoon.
Don't shoot my son. Yeah. Please don't shoot my son.
In a video released by a bystander, the officers fired a number of shots as the younger Wallace didn't heed orders to drop the knife as he came at them. His father, Walter Wallace Sr.
Every time I close my eyes, I get a flashback about multiple shots.
The elder Wallace says he wants someone held accountable, but he also wants peaceful protests, not violence.
Cause no chaos, violent, looting, fire, all this thing, because I wasn't brought up like that.
I'm Tim McGuire.
This is VOA. People across Poland are vowing to stay off their jobs Wednesday as part of a nationwide strike to protest a top court's ruling that would impose a near total ban on abortions. The Constitutional Court's ruling last Thursday would deny legal abortions to women, even in cases where a child is sure to die upon birth. Since then, there have been daily mass protests, the AP reports, with anger directed at the Catholic Church and the ruling party leader Jarosław Kaczynski. Women entered churches on Sunday to disrupt masses, confronting priests with obscenities and spray-painting church buildings. Late Tuesday, Kaczynski accused protesters of seeking, quote, to destroy Poland, end quote, and called on his party's supporters to defend churches, quote, at any cost, end quote. Republican and Democratic lawmakers sharply criticized the head of the U.S. Agency for Global Media, which oversees the Voice of America, for his repeal of a rule meant to protect VOA and other U.S.-funded news networks from editorial interference. In a statement late Monday, CEO Michael Pack said he was rolling back the regulation regarding what is known as the firewall because he said it was harmful to the agency's and national interests. Previous USAGM leadership adopted the rule in June, days before Pack was confirmed by the U.S. Senate as CEO. Pack's decree does not impact the firewall statutes included in a 1994 law on U.S. broadcasting, which was designed to shelter journalists from interference. Pack, however, characterized it as an unconstitutional and unworkable misinterpretation. Several members of Congress spoke out against Pack's change, including Republican House member Michael McCaul of Texas. He told VOA that without journalistic objectivity at USAGM networks, quote, the mission and effectiveness of the agency is undermined, end quote. You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. The war between Armenia and Azerbaijan in the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh may be the latest episode in the power struggle between Turkey and Russia. For more on how the geopolitical rivalry is shaping that conflict, I reached out to journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul.
These two countries are traditional regional rivals, be it in Syria, be it even now in Libya as well. And the latest sign of those tensions is now the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. Now, Moscow has been backing Armenia. It has a defense alliance with Armenia and is seen as a key ally in this ongoing conflict in Nagorno-Karabakh, where Turkey is Azerbaijan's main military and political allies. And the fact that Turkey's military support selling its key sophisticated weapons to Azerbaijan and seen as a possible game changer in that conflict has, according to reports, taken Moscow by surprise and has caused a growing alarm in Moscow over what it sees as Turkey muscling into an area where it believes it has a hegemony.
As you say, Turkey has been supporting Azerbaijan quite a bit, but Russia, at least publicly, doesn't seem to be as overtly supporting Armenia. Moscow's even pushed for a ceasefire, no?
Well, that's certainly how it's trying to position itself. For sure, Moscow isn't exactly enamored with the present Armenian regime. They seem to be concerned that possibly that Armenia could be trying to weaken its ties with Russia and look more towards a more balanced approach, cultivating growing ties with the West. So Moscow is seen to be not as supportive, possibly, as it would have been in the past over this deepening conflict. This is the worst fighting since the 1990s. Hundreds have been killed on both sides, possibly thousands. Having said that, I think that people understand that they would be deeply concerned if Azerbaijan scored a total victory. It reclaimed the whole of Nagorno-Karabakh, given the fact that Turkey is so strongly backing Azerbaijan. So for now, they are seen to present themselves as an honest broker, and they've been working very hard to secure an unconditional ceasefire, backed, incidentally, by France and in the United States. But Azerbaijan has been very resolute. It says there can be no unconditional ceasefire until they get a commitment from Armenia to withdraw from all of Azeri territory. And the main cheerleader, the strongest supporter of that stance, is seen as Turkey.
So does Armenia have any strong military backer?
Well, certainly, Azerbaijan does appear to have made major military gains in this conflict, and a key part of those gains is seen to be Turkish drones, which the Azeri president, Ilham Aliyev, has said is key, inflicting massive damage, he claimed, on Armenian forces. And for sure, Azerbaijan's an extremely oil-rich, energy-rich country. It has spent huge amounts of money on defense purchases in the lead-up to this confrontation. But having said that, Armenia does have this defense alliance with Moscow. In fact, Russia has a military base in Armenia, and there has been possible speculation that possibly Russia will be looking to deploy peacekeeping forces to enforce any ceasefire. Now, Ankara has been very lukewarm on that possibility.
That was journalist Dorian Jones in Istanbul. The World Health Organization said countries globally reported more than 2 million confirmed coronavirus cases last week, the shortest time ever for such an exponential increase since the pandemic began. The WHO said the European region accounted for the biggest proportion of new cases, with more than 1.3 million reported cases, or about 46% of the worldwide total. The UN Health Agency said deaths were also on the rise in Europe, with about a 35% increase since the previous week. The head of the European Union Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said today that the delivery of potential COVID-19 vaccines to EU countries could begin in earnest in April.
In best case scenarios, we could see monthly deliveries of about 20 to 15 million doses of vaccines. The moment the first companies start to signal that they are on the road, the big numbers of supplies are due to start in April.
Globally, the WHO said the countries reporting the highest numbers of cases remain unchanged for the past 3 weeks: India, the UK, France, Brazil, and the US. In the U.S., cases averaged nearly 72,000 cases a day for the past week, with over 800 deaths. Johns Hopkins University data show. AP's Sagar Meghani reports.
Hawaii is the only state not seeing cases go up. The average number of new cases each day has jumped more than 40% nationally over the past 2 weeks, and deaths have increased in 34 states. Illinois' governor has now banned indoor dining and drinking in Chicago, and authorities in El Paso, Texas, are telling residents to stay home for 2 weeks.
That was AP's Sagar Meghani. There are many possible COVID-19 vaccines in development, but healthcare professionals are warning that once they're ready for use, it may not mean that it's time to end the preventative measures put in place during the pandemic. International Edition's Steve Miller spoke to VOA science correspondent Steve Barragona to learn why.
The expectation has been that, okay, you know, the vaccine is coming, and once the vaccine comes, then we can get back to normal. And I think what a lot of the folks that I talked to were saying was that, well, I mean, eventually we hope so, but we can't say that at this point. There's a lot of questions about the vaccine that we just don't know right now. I mean, the big one and the most obvious one is we just don't know how well it's going to work. A lot of childhood vaccines are great. Measles, mumps, rubella, those kinds of things, you get it once and you're done. You are protected for life. And they're like 90 some odd percent effective. We don't know with this vaccine how effective it's going to be and how long it's going to last. The FDA has set 50% effective as kind of their benchmark. They want to see clinical trials that show this vaccine prevents infection or reduces severity of infection in at least half of the people who get it. That means the other half, you know, can get the vaccine and still get sick.
Does that mean that if you do have the vaccine and you yourself are protected against, I guess, the mal effects of it, but could you, you know, be a carrier and infect other people? Do they know that?
No, they don't. And that's a big concern with this vaccine, too. I saw one paper described as a worst case scenario. It would be a vaccine that primes your immune system to fight off the virus. And it fights it off as well enough so that you don't get sick, but you'd still be infected and you'd still be carrying the virus. And that means that you can pass the virus on to others. And this is why they're really stressing that you'll still need to wear a mask. We'll still need to social distance until we've really got this thing under control. And we don't really know how long that's going to be. I mean, it's not a happy message. It's not necessarily something that people are going to want to hear. People are already tired of the COVID precautions, and they're not going to be thrilled about hearing that, okay, I got vaccinated, but I still can't take off my mask, and I still can't go to a movie theater safely. But, you know, unfortunately, the virus doesn't necessarily care how tired of it you are. It's still out there.
Are they worried at all that once a COVID-19 vaccine is available and ready to be distributed, that there may be some hesitancy among the world's population of using it?
Yeah, there's a lot of concern about that, too, that in the U.S., we've seen people's willingness to get a vaccine right away has gone down over the past few months. I mean, as the vaccine has gotten closer, fewer people are saying that they will run out and get it as soon as it's available. And that could potentially be bad news in the big picture.
That was VOA science correspondent Steve Barragona speaking to International Edition's Steve Miller. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Damage was averted at the United Nations in March when the People's Republic of China, the PRC, a notorious violator of intellectual property rights, failed in its bid to head the UN organization charged with protecting those same rights, the World Intellectual Property Organization. Unfortunately, a serious travesty was not averted in October at the UN. The General Assembly voted again to place some of the world's worst human rights abusers on the Human Rights Council, including the PRC, Russia, and Cuba. Human rights activists were shocked. Serial rights abusers should not be rewarded with seats on the Human Rights Council, said Louis Charbonneau, UN Director at Human Rights Watch. Hillel Neuer, executive director of UN Watch, called it a black day for human rights. In its most recent human rights report, the U.S. State Department documented a myriad of egregious human rights abuses in the PRC, including mass detention of Muslim minority groups in Xinjiang. In Russia, the State Department detailed extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrest, and severe suppression of freedoms of expression, among other abuses. In Cuba, a police state, government security forces intimidated and physically assaulted human rights and pro-democracy advocates on a daily basis and denied freedom of association to the Cuban people. UN General Assembly Resolution 60/251, which created the Human Rights Council, requires council members to uphold the highest standards in the promotion and protection of human rights. The election of the PRC, Russia, and Cuba this year, and Venezuela last year, shows the council is not only a shadow but a mockery of what it was created to be. In a statement, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo pointed out that the United States withdrew from the Human Rights Council in 2000. 2018 due to its well-established pattern of anti-Israel bias and membership rules that allowed the election of the world's worst human rights abusers to seats on the council. He noted that prior to exiting, the United States had urged UN member states to take immediate action to reform the council before it became irreparable. Unfortunately, he said, those calls went unheeded. This year's election further validates the U.S. decision to withdraw from the council and use other venues and opportunities to protect and promote universal human rights, said Secretary Pompeo. Our commitments are spelled out clearly in the U.N.'s Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in our record of action.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.